Our latest episode of Soundtracking is another live event recorded at the British Film Institute in London with writer, director and actor Andy Serkis and musician Nitin Soni. Now, the pair have collaborated on several occasions, most recently on Mowgli, Legend of the Jungle, Andy's performance capture reimagining of The Jungle Book. It's available to watch now via Netflix, and if you haven't seen it already, I highly recommend it. Nitin also provided the score for Breathe, Andy's directorial debut. As always, you'll hear plenty of music from both films during the conversation, and plenty more besides, starting with a cue from Mowgli called Campfire. Thank you for being here. God, give us a kiss. Mwah. Oh, two? I never know. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for being here.
We've got...
Can we swear?
You can swear if you want. Yeah, straight away.
I just wondered, I can't remember.
Is that a thing that you do where you get it out
before? I like to swear straight away.
Yes, swearing is absolutely fine.
All right,
yeah, okay. Absolutely fine. Listen, thanks for being here. There's a welcome back to the podcast, actually, because we've been lucky that we had you on before when you were releasing Breathe, which we will talk about and show some fabulous clips. Welcome to Soundtracking, Nitin.
Thank you.
I mean, you definitely deserve your own episode, at least one on your own, because the work that you've done as a musician and a composer is huge, really. But where did this relationship start? How did this relationship start?
Well, we've just actually worked out about 5 minutes ago that we thought it was, well, I thought it was Heavenly Sword,
yeah, so
which is
I.
a video game.
Which that, was that, about 2004.
2004.
But actually, it goes back to about 1991, because we did a play together, which we've both forgotten about, called The Rover.
It's the 90s for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So we worked together in about 1991.
Yeah, it was a production of an Afro Ben play called The Rover, which was a play and was performed at a very old film studio called Jacob Street Film Studios. And it was so during the day we were actually filming it, because it was a huge set and in the round space, and then at night we were performing it as a play. So it's a very, very bizarre thing. And I've just found out that Nitin wrote the music for it, and I didn't even realise.
And I was there watching you going through all the rehearsals and workshops and stuff.
Were you in your head going, I want to work with him one day?
Yeah, I was.
Then how did Heavenly Sword happen? How did that kind of come
about?
Well,
I think you already started working with Tamimen.
That's right. So in fact, it was just after, it was in 2004, and I'd just come back from New Zealand having shot King Kong with Peter Jackson, and I was approached by, weirdly, it was a really weird connection, actually, but by I went to get a mortgage for my house, actually, and... I was sitting there, and me and my wife Lorraine, and this guy was going, and there's 12. This and 12.5 that percent, and blah blah blah. And can I just show you something? And he turned it round and pressed play, and it was a video game trailer. And I thought, this is very weird. This is very strange. And he said, my brother makes video games and he really wants to meet you and to talk about using performance capture in video games. At that time, of course, video games were very much about hack and slash and not really much about story and content or character. So we started talking and so this is a rather long-winded story. And finally, you know, we got together and it was a really amazing script and it was quite a groundbreaking video game. I wasn't really a gamer, but you were, weren't you?
You were a little bit.
Played a lot of games, but it was. We rehearsed it like a film and directed all the actors and then when we came to make it, we had to go with the technology we didn't have in this country to do what we needed to do using performance capture. So took everybody over to New Zealand. When we came back, I couldn't think. I mean, the very first person that I thought of to work with on it, because of the subject matter, was Nitin, and he just wrote the most incredible music. I mean, and hours. And what was it like writing for a video game? Because I don't think you'd ever done that either.
No, it's amazing because it's technically very different to writing for films. You've got to account for all the success and failure paths. So when people are playing these games, rather than going doing a wah wah wah, when somebody actually fails, you've actually got that music. I don't know, that could work. But yeah, you've got to write music that kind of somehow reflects the internal psychology of the person who's playing it as well. And there are techniques to doing that and ways in which. So you have to work very closely with the technical team. Yeah.
Like that, of kind of your gaming journey that you have to take.
How many hours of music?
It works out to be about 30 or 40 hours of music. Yeah. So compared to a normal film, you have so many, because you have all the different platforms that you go through. And so, you know, there are so many possibilities that you have to account for in the way that you write the music, because it's not a linear progression like a film is.
And because you have that amount of music that you have to write, is it a lovely thing that do you have more freedom because you can kind of go for it, really, because you do have that amount of time to write music for?
Yeah, and also because the characters in video games are they're more archetypal, I think, than they are in, I don't know why that is, but they are, they're more kind of, you know, you have an evil king who is really clearly evil, and you'll have
that guy there.
So you'll have, sorry, but you'll have, you know, all the characters are very definitely, you know, characters you will have come across before in some form, and so there are really strong associations musically with them, and it's a lot clearer in terms of how you grasp, I suppose, what who they are and the kind of music you create than with film, which is more nuanced, I think. I mean, that was at the time. I don't know.
When did you start working on composing for film?
That was back in about 93, because I worked on a film which was about an Asian women's refuge for the BBC, and it was a film called Flight. And that film, I really enjoyed doing it. Actually, it come from, because I was making albums at the same time, solo albums, and my first album I'd just done, and this guy, I think his name's Alex Pillay, he'd actually heard the music for that and just asked me if I'd write the whole score, which is great. And I used to sit there in my bedroom with a video recorder and trying to synchronize between what I was doing with the key, you know, with the keyboard and sequences and whatever I was using to record the music. So it's literally, it'd be like that, just kind of as opposed to kind of, you know, the way we do things now. But yeah, it was great doing it. Thank you.
Were there soundtracks or music within film for both of you that, that really resonated as a film fan that, that have kind of stuck with you?
Leonard Bernstein's Taxi Driver, I guess, I've always adored.
You mean Bernard Herrmann?
Bernard Herrmann.
Who recorded that? That's
which
the one.
Sounds a little
Different
bit
Burns.
Like Leonard Bernstein. Not.
He recorded that with the Scottish Symphony Orchestra.
Did
it's
really?
A little fact for you on that one, yeah.
Great sax on that. Great sax.
Oh, yeah. Here's the fact. How many people in the audience knew that Andy Serkis was a shit-hot saxophonist? Oh, a couple of you. There's the super fans in the audience. How long have you been playing the saxophone?
Since about 13. I started playing the clarinet when I was about 7 or 8. And then and I was very, very lucky because I had some very... In fact, there's someone in the audience, I think, tonight who I actually played a lot with. Is Yuki here? I think you, yeah, anyway, some very, very close family friends of mine. I thought he was here tonight, but perhaps he's not. Anyway, Yuki, wherever you are.
That was kind of exciting for about half a second.
It was, wasn't it? I started playing with some neighbours of ours and just graduated onto the sax. I always loved the sound of the sax. Mm. After Acker Bilk, I think Strangers on the Shore on the clarinet was the first thing I learned.
Tone Andy's got as well, and so much so that we actually got him playing sax in Breathe, and he sounds amazing in it. So yeah,
funny you should mention Breathe. That was amazingly seamless. That was brilliant. Breathe is the first thing that we as film fans got to see and hear that you'd worked together, even though Mowgli was filmed by this point. Is that right?
Yes. So that the strange old life that it is. So we started shooting Mowgli, or as it was at that point, Jungle Book, in 2014, I think it was. And so we'd been through the whole principal photography part of it, which was a long old shoot, and we'll come back to that. But then in the sort of a very, very long post-production of it all, we found ourselves able to shoot this amazing film, which had been on our slate at the Imaginarium, which is the production company that myself and Jonathan Cavendish have.
Yeah.
A very personal film about his parents called Breathe. And, you know, it's the most extraordinary story of survival, and not just survival, but a sort of very uplifting response to a tragedy and laughing in the face of adversity, really, I suppose. The story is that Jonathan's parents were very totally in love with each other, very happily in love in the 50s, turn of the 50s into the 60s. And then his father got struck down with polio when they were in Africa, and he was given a couple of days to live. And he happened to be in a hospital where a travelling doctor was able to give him an emergency tracheostomy. And then he basically survived, went through a big depression, was flown back to England. And then there was a crux point where he was in a depression, and Diana, his wife, said, look, he'd given up on life, basically. And she said, I want you to choose life. And he said, OK, I'll choose life on one condition. You get me out of hospital. And no one had ever lived with his condition outside of the hospital system with polio. So it's about them choosing to go on this adventure, living sort of 2 minutes away from death, but living life to the full. And you know, I absolutely, well, I, you know, we sent you, what did we send you?
We sent you a cut of the
film. And I couldn't think of anyone else I'd rather work with than Nitin on it. It required a very delicate sort of soundscape and musical landscape, which travels through years, it travels emotionally, you know, through huge kind of peaks and troughs.
Continents.
And it needed to be, you know, it needed to swell, it needed to, you know, be uplifting, but also very, very delicate, because a lot of the scenes are very, you know, Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy magnificently act together, and it was very deft what they were doing. So, I mean, the music, I think, was a huge challenge.
I mean, I quite often try to find a theme, you know, and some kind of overture or something that kind of that I can pull apart in different ways and interpret in different ways through a film. But it needs to feel like I need to find a melody that captures the essence of the main characters and their journey. So it was a case of just sitting down at a piano and just playing around, which is what I did with Mowgli as well. I mean, it's kind of I find that's the best way to approach things from the beginning.
We've got a clip here from there's a lovely theme that, like you say, that kind of it almost represents their love that kind of comes in and out the film, and there's a we can hear part of that right now.
You can't possibly marry him, Diana. He's practically a stranger.
Is he stranger than us, do you think? Not much in it?
Has he got any money at all?
No.
It's not as if you don't have other options. What about that Hugh? Didn't he have a castle in Scotland? Mind you, who wants to live in Scotland?
Oh, do shut up. She's talking about going to live in Kenya, for God's sake.
Tell me to shut up.
Diana? Please stop going round and round and concentrate. This is your future life we're talking about. It's your future happiness.
The thing is, I just know this is it.
Thank you.
I'm all right, darling.
Just before we talk about the music, I love the reaction. The beautiful, just kind of feels such a genuine reaction there. And I kind of almost think that Andrew's driving of that plane looks terrifying. And it was genuinely Claire going, yeah, I think I'm all right.
they were truly, as characters, they truly kind of were totally in love with each other. I mean, it was an amazing experience. I mean, their chemistry was remarkable in that film. You know, it was a really extraordinary film for the fact that what we wanted to do at the beginning, which is the music that you heard there, was very much lead the audience into a sense of this is going to be a very romantic, very, very nostalgic piece of filmmaking, and sort of lead them to think it's going to be like a Out of Africa or a, you know, and before the tragedy hits, and so that was the purpose of the music at the front, was to lull you into this kind of sense of it being a real nostalgia trip.
Feels like a swelling heart almost when you see that, and that. It's so beautiful, that shot, the shot of the plane, and then the music just complements. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, the scenes, I mean, you can see they're gorgeous scenes. So they spoke so eloquently in themselves. So it wasn't difficult to find a musical vocabulary that kind of went with them.
But how it starts, like you say, that simplicity of the piano, that then it kind of grows.
Yeah, literally that. Yeah. So and then, you know, I'll kind of get into mocking things up as well with you know, virtual instruments, and then we went to Air Studios and recorded with strings there. So yeah, and Andy's brilliant saxophone, which you heard there, which is amazing.
Very much. Actually, what was brilliant about working on that was you know, talking about that sort of sparsity at times, you know, going from that full sound to being sparse. I mean, I remember right up until the very, very last day of the mix, there was one piece of music which we took out literally on our very, very last day. And what's so great about Nitin as an extraordinary musician, but also a brilliant collaborator, is that to take music out that you've written and be happy for it to be out. Because do you remember do you remember that scene?
It's a love scene between them.
It really needed to just to have silence. And there was a beautiful piece of music, and it was just like, God, are we really going to take this out? And actually, the counterpoint of it not being there really kind of did work.
So, yeah, it made sense. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like when
it's
you...
It's better when your music wasn't there, in fact.
Yeah, generally. I find that, actually, in most things. but no, I think it's also about pacing things. You know, for me, silence is actually a great way to frame music and to frame how we absorb the psychology of music. You know, I mean, from listening to Miles Davis when I was a kid, you know, who was a master of how to control silence and sound. And I think... I've always, you know, thought that my favourite films are when it's very judged where to place the music, as opposed to just a wall of continuous sound.
Yeah. We have a couple more clips from Breathe, and the next one is a lovely little scene. And I know that you, because temp in a film can be tricky for composers sometimes in terms of, okay, I've temped the film, can you make it sound a little bit like this? But that wasn't the case with what you temped the scene with, because it was more about the comedic side of it almost. I think, or correct me if I'm wrong, but it Absolutely. Was The Great Escape that you tempted it with.
What was it? Yeah, I think it was. It was something like that. So basically, there's a turning point in the film where the moment I was describing earlier, where she says, she says, how can I get you to choose life? And he says, get me out of hospital. And so, and we wanted this sort of upturn in the film where it becomes almost like an Ealing comedy, you know, or a sort of a caper movie where they're literally trying to get him out. The fact of the matter is true. They literally legged it out of the hospital. and this was the piece of music that Nitin came up with for it, which is amazing. Thank you.
conversations that you specifically had, like basically what you just told us there about what you're looking for that specific scene?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, working with Andy, he's musically, you know, obviously because he's a sax player, but also he's got a great sense of musicality in the way he thinks. But it's about finding common references, you know, in terms of vocabulary and how we kind of define that. And I think also the characterization, there's so many things you have to take into account, but I kind of liked that kind of spoons type thing. There was something in my head that was kind of comical about that. But at the same time, you know, you have to kind of think about the period that it's in. Mm. You have to think about the pacing of it, but also you don't want it to stand away or to stand out as too different from the rest of the score. There's a lot of kind of factors that you have to take into account to come up with something like that. But I really enjoyed it. It was great.
And I guess as well, because you had the luxury of Jonathan and his mum in terms of, you know, this was their story and there was a lot of music around in there. World and yeah. Genuinely you wanted to, you know, incorporate that into the film, but also speaking to them about how the sound of the film would be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was remarkable. So Diana is still around, and she's very much around, and and they are they're an incredible unit, actually, Jonathan and Diana. So to have and we had that some of the family members who were very, very active in passing down all the stories and a lot of it. I mean, there isn't really anything in the movie that didn't actually happen. Remarkably, I mean, it is a really extraordinary journey they went on. So they've fueled us with just tons of stories and like you say, the tone and the musicality at the time and what they were listening to and so on. So it was just a one, you know, it was actually a truly wonderful experience making that movie, really.
Because is it True Love, the Grace
True
Kelly
Love,
and
yeah.
Bing Crosby track?
That was their favourite song. That's the one that we had to keep in the movie, which wasn't original.
Yeah.
Suntan, wind blown, honeymooners at last along, feeling far above par. Oh, how lucky we are. While I give to you and you give to me,
as well, with this soundtrack and the score that you created, that you were able to really kind of pull on the wonderful instrumentalist that you are in terms of the different type of instruments that you play and the different genres of music that you can play. Flamenco is a big thing of yours. I've seen you play. You're amazing, and that must be quite nice to be able to kind of explore that as well, with it not being a, you know, as people would see a traditional score, of it just being strings and orchestration sort of thing. And
yeah, it was nice in that there were lots of moments that, you know, I mean, there was, for example, a garden party scene where they wanted something, Andy wanted something that kind of felt a little bit Burt Bacharach.
Thank you.
so that was nice to actually come up with something like that. But then there was one scene that you might be referring to, which was in Spain. And I think you'd recorded some diegetic music with some actual performers in Spain, some flamenco players. And then I had to write music that kind of segued into that. So it was kind of trying to keep true to that feeling of being in Spain, but again, trying to also make it sit with the rest of the score.
So they finally, Robin, Diana's husband, they decide to go abroad for the first time, and it's a really dangerous thing. And she's like, "This is such a bad idea to go abroad when you're living on a respirator. If anything goes wrong, we're done," you know. And they had this emergency sort of bag which they could pump air to should the respirator break down. But you know, to travel to another country in the late 1960s, early 70s. It was truly, truly risking it, and so that's what leads into this.
Wow. Spain.
Spain. We can't, Robin.
Oh.
Robin, oh, you really mean it, don't you? No, how on earth do we go to Spain?
Well, by a plane, of course.
Darling. How do we get you on a plane?
On that, I've just remembered it only turns. I only put in the flamenco bit towards the back end of that in the transition, but I it kind of worked from what came before, and then I kind of brought in the flamenco stuff, so it kind of made a bit more sense.
Totally. What do you put on your down as your occupation when you're filling out form? I mean, you're so many things. That's, you know.
I honestly struggle to think there of anything that knitting can't do. It's just the most sickening polymath of all time. You know, really, honestly, truly, brilliant writer, brilliant comedian, brilliant performer, brilliant, so many albums, film composer, you know, activist. It really is quite.
Oh,
thank
you.
Genius.
Yeah. Before we move on to talking about Mowgli, I wanted to ask, if you don't mind, about Last Days of Meaning with John Hurt, if you would mind, which is an album that you released back in 2011.
Yeah.
And just talk a little bit about that experience and how that came about.
I was made a fellow at Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, Paul McCartney's thing, and I'd worked with Paul McCartney before, and I was made a fellow of that, and that's where I met John Hurt and his wife Anwen, and we got on really well, and he became a really good friend, and we worked on a series called The Human Planet together for the BBC, and in fact I'd suggested him to be the narrator for that, which he did so brilliantly. And then we just got on well, and I had written a character, which is so weird when I look at it now, because the character was called Donald Meaning. And I had this, and it's 2011, and I had him as this kind of weird parochial guy who was scared of immigrants. And if you see the front cover of the album, it may look a little bit like a certain person. And I had not got that in my head. And it's kind of eerie to me. Yeah. But anyway, but I got John Hurt into play this character. And it's a little bit kind of Crap's Last Tapes kind of thing, you know, the Beckett play.
Sick of it. Stupid games. I'm not your toy. Your plaything. You had your time. I gave you your chances. You can't manipulate me anymore. Not now. Anyway. What's that bloody noise? Hello? Stop banging! It's late! Bloody immigrants. Bloody terrorists. Bloody... bloody freezing in here. I bet if I blew, yeah, condensation on my breath, I should take a photo of that. I will show the lot of them. The council, stupid politicians. When the papers see, then they'll all be out. Scandalous. Can't treat an old man like that. I'm old. Cold. Old and cold. Rotting in mould, boldly listening to stories untold, with no songs to sing and no one to hold. No songs to sing. Perhaps another.
So I kind of wanted to bring someone in who had that kind of gravitas, who could play this character, and I used it. I mean, it was such a weird experimental album. I don't know what to make of it now or what anyone else does, but for me, I just like doing things that feel right, and I made it at the time, and it was kind of... it's interesting listening back to it now because it feels more relevant now than it did then, but it's... yeah, so he was incredible, and I actually kind of got to write his lines and work with him, and... yeah, what an amazing privilege. And we stayed friends. You know, I went to the hospital just a couple of weeks before he passed away, and I was wheeling him around in his wheelchair, and we had a great game of chess, and he was an amazing human being, yeah. Yeah, one of my favourite people.
How bloody weird. Is that it? She sends me that? After... how long is it now? Have some gloves or socks. Typical. She leaves, fine. She feels bad, fine. So all she can do, just rubbish. Haven't got the... Who's that? Hello? Who's there? Anyway... anyway, here it is now. There's nothing else. Perhaps another one. What was it? Press down.
Talking about working with amazing people, we're going to talk about Mowgli next, and the performances that you've got from your cast and their performance capture in this is just extraordinary. And the way that these animals in particular are really brought to life, and the emotions that they convey. And I imagine that for, you know, these are pretty well-established names that we're talking about, Christian Bale and the likes, but you're the king of that world in terms of what you've done for that world and what you've created over the years is just extraordinary. And in particular for me, Caesar, that character that we saw through a number of films, and seeing that character develop, so emotional. Yeah. But when you are working with actors who maybe haven't done that type of work before, do you have to, you know, not just directing them, but direct them specifically for that side of things? Or
I mean, it's very interesting because a lot of people have kind of misconceptions about what performance capture is, and they think that it's some sort of you have to overact or pantomime or sort of behave in a particular kind of way. But or of course, like if you're playing animals, then you have to observe and you have to observe their behaviour and so on. But when we sat around for the table read of Mowgli, and you know we've got, you know, Cate Blanchett's there and Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Hollander and Naomi Harris and you know just the whole gang, and they're all going, what's the secret of performance capture? And I go, you know, the truth is there is no secret about it. It's just acting. It's just creating a character. And what you're doing is you are meeting the creature that you're playing. So yes, by all means, go ahead and really study and observe and find some physicality that works towards the animal that you're playing. But you're not playing a panther, you're playing Bagheera. So who is Bagheera and what and actually that finally comes down to character choices about and they're all real anthropomorphizations of animals anyway. So they felt more kind of freed up after that. And I do think that, you know, it only takes a very short space of time for an actor to, you know, they think, oh my gosh, I'm going to be wearing a suit with dots all over my face and a head-mounted camera and I'm going to feel really weird. And it literally takes about 5 minutes before you're looking into the eyes of another actor and you're just communicating with them as the character. And it's a very, you know, my job in that case was to just sort of make people just relax and concentrate on the roles that they were playing, which they just took to, like, ducks to water. And they sort of... And the amazing different kind of physical range of what people were doing, of what people wanted to do and ended up doing. I mean, Peter Mullen, who was playing Akela, the Wolfpack leader, totally stoic, didn't move a muscle, was just very, very solid, and everything was in his eyes and in his face, through to Tom Hollander, who's playing Tabaki, this whirling dervish kind of hyena who had crutches and was, you know, scrambling around and flying about all over the place, and Benedict, of course, playing Shere Khan, the tiger, and huge physicality, and found this kind of, you know, the voice that came into what he was doing was, you know, you've heard this thing about, you know, when he says man cub, he's man cub, you know, it was just like, it was just great to see different people's responses as to how you can bring a character to life. Yeah. You know.
Was it easy to cast?
It was very easy to cast. I mean, the great thing is that we had these amazing actors who all wanted to have a go. They all wanted to experience something different in their careers, you know, where they got to where it was just like very, very different from doing sort of maybe a sort of another version of themselves in a way. It was really required them to dig deep and to make fools of themselves and they all went for it and came up with you know, as I'm glad you're saying, you know, kind of very, very truthful, emotional, beautiful, big performances. Mm.
Because you were in charge, were you like, okay, I'm gonna go with Baloo. I want to be Baloo.
In actual fact, no. That, you know what? We looked around because I wasn't going to be in it because I knew I'd have my hands full. I wasn't going to be in it at all. No, and I knew it was a big operation and it was going to take all my sort of headspace as a director. But we asked a few actors, and I think people were kind of like, Baloo's sort of like, of all of the characters that are sort of memorable from the Disney one, I think that's the one that people remember. And I think that there was something kind of maybe scary about doing that. And then, so we didn't have any response to that character when we were casting it. So we ended up all looking at each other and getting close to the time when we were about to shoot. And someone said, well, why, Andy, why don't you do it? And I'm like, oh, go on now. You know, so it was...
I've got a little video which you two are very scared about me showing. I've got to thank Catherine, who's in the audience, for giving it to me. You can tell that it's been slightly filmed sort of inconspicuously, like behind a couple of bottles of water. This was in South Africa, is this right?
Yes, where we shot Mowgli on location.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a bit of, I guess, downtime in what looks like a conference suite. But let's take a look. This is just the two of them kind of hanging out and jamming. Here we go. Isn't that awesome? Your little face at the end. Do you know? Secretly filming. That's lovely. But I know that there was a lot of research and prep that went into
just that one piece of music.
Just for that one piece of music from Mowgli because we were working together on a TV show, and you came back one week and you were like, you'd been injured from a research trip with Andy to, yes. Was it South Africa?
Yes, it was, yeah. So Andy has this wonderful way with understatement where he will say something like, would you like to join me on a nature walk? And I thought, images of Kew Gardens come to mind. I thought, that's lovely. Yeah, of course, I'd love to. So I get to his place, his apartment, and he just goes, oh, hang on a minute, maybe you should change your shoes. I've got some hiking boots for you. And I went, okay, great. So I'm wearing these hiking boots that I didn't actually notice were cutting into my leg at the time. I don't know how many hours it was later, but quite a few hours later, we were still on the side of some kind of a rock thing with lots of foliage, and Andy had handed me a stick to fight my way through. And then we got Jonathan. Somebody called me from on my phone while I was trying to light my way so that I didn't actually fall down a crevice of something. And whoever it was said, should we not be sending out a search party for you right now? Because it's pitch black. And I said, Andy, are you all right? Do you know where we are? He said, yeah, we're fine. So I was like, no, we're okay. Can I just get you off the phone now? Because I need to see how I'm going to jump over this. So it was just quite a mad experience. But what happened was when I got back to the, because Andy climbs regularly and I don't. And we got back to his Jeep in the end, which was one of the greatest moments of my life. And, I remember getting in the Jeep and we got to Andy's place, and I was with the driver, and Andy said, oh, that was great. I said, that was amazing, really enjoyed that. Andy goes into his apartment. I just screamed at the top of my voice in absolute agony. And so I didn't tell Andy about that.
And the purpose of the hike was
just torture. No, I think it was just and bonding, which we did. We had some really good conversations.
Quite in-depth conversations.
Yeah, as we walked through the gates of hell.
Where did you start with the music and what you wanted for Mowgli?
Mowgli again was. I knew that Nitin was the only person that who could write this score, and just knowing his breadth and scope and scale of understanding of world music and the sort of sounds that we wanted for a piece, which wasn't going to be a typical kind of blockbuster movie. This was going to be always our version of Jungle Book. Mowgli was always going to be a slightly darker look at the world of Rudyard Kipling and his whole the time, the placement of it, very much making it of India, making it feel, you know, that it really did belong to, that it was an Indian story. And that we, when we first started to talk about it, it was the idea of creating a soundscape so that the music could sort of talk to the sound of the jungle, really, so that it was, so that you could slip seamlessly between, you know, pick up on bird song or insects, or, I mean, you'd actually written a symphony for animals, hadn't you?
I worked a lot with the BBC with Natural History Unit. So I'd done Human Planet. I did Wonders of the Monsoon, which I think we used some of that. And then I'd done something called, which had been called Natural World Symphony. And then I also did something called Animal Symphony. So, yeah, I've worked a lot with...
Can you tell me about, because I remember watching that.
Which one?
The Animal Symphony one with the recording of the birds and all of that and getting...
Oh, that was with Chris Packham. Yeah, with that. So, I mean, because I had to write something in the, which actually got across, the sounds of that a cuckoo makes. And actually, no, it wasn't a cuckoo, it was a nightingale. I don't know why I lied just then.
That could be the next episode.
So, yeah, it was a nightingale. And I remember being with Chris Packham, and he was kind of recording these amazing sounds. And it's interesting because, you know, there's this kind of romanticized view of what a nightingale would sound like, but it's nothing like a nightingale sounds. I mean, nightingale will make crazy random noises and do all kinds of things that play with your sense of perception of sound. And there is a musicality to it that's really weird. So actually trying to capture that in a real orchestrated piece of music was quite interesting.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, because I'd done a few things. I mean, there was one scene which was from Wonder the Monsoon, which I think used as temp, where I think they'd been talking about, you know, Jungle Book itself, and they made that analogy with some of the animals that were there. So it was quite handy to be able to use some of those cues as references.
Was there idea of kind of having themes for the different characters as well, and or not?
It was thematic, but it was. I mean, we wanted to eventually find a theme for Mowgli for sure. Which got. I mean, that was such an incredible moment, and it was quite late on actually. We'd been. I mean, but we talked about this movie. This movie took a long time to make. It took 5 years to make, and sort of we'd started talking right at the beginning about it, but it was literally in the fourth year, I think it was, that knitting. I don't know how you did it, but I think you'd sat down and you'd watch lots of clips, or you'd put lots of Mowgli clips together. But he sent me this piece of music, and I was actually away having a break, and I was on holiday in Italy, and you know, this came through on my phone, and I played it, and it was just extraordinary. And I remember kind of just almost, I was with Lorraine, my wife, and I said, you've got to listen to this. And it was just, and we practically both wept. It was just bang on, because our Mowgli needed to be, he's an outsider, and he is an outsider, and he is other, and he grows up torn between these two worlds of animal and of man, and he's at a very tender age where he's not quite knowing how he's placing himself in the world, and yet, so there's definitely this sort of the wiliness and adventurousness and the heroic journey that he's going to go on, but there's also this underlying kind of vulnerability, and it just all came out in this extraordinary piece.
This is one of the clips we were actually able to get that's got a really kind of that build in music, and also how the music is kind of intertwined with the action as well, and kind of the real sounds of what's going on in and around the scene. So let's play this one.
Whoa. Let the man come alone. He belongs to us.
Brilliant. If you haven't seen it yet, it's so great. And that was nice because it let us see quite a few of the characters as well. And yeah, that little tiny subtle injection of like the snake charmer sound sort of thing as well. There's so much in there.
I mean, I was lucky enough to work with some great musicians from India, but I'd written all those melodies and so on. And one of the instruments is actually, towards the end, it's called a swaleen, but I put it together with another well-known classical instrument called a sarangi. And it really has that kind of movement of a snake in the way that the melodies work and the way you can play the melodies as well. So that's a particular rag as well, which is an Indian classical rag called Rag Bhairavi, which is quite a melancholic rag. It was just about how that blended in with the rest of it. Really.
Best bit of the job for you when you get to record them, you know, in a big studio where everything's kind of being recorded live and things, is that?
Oh, I mean, the Air Studios with an 87-piece orchestra is incredible. I mean, you were there for that.
It was just remarkable. It is. It's when you know, it's such a satisfying, beautiful moment of the filmmaking process where, you know, the picture's locked, and you're concentrating on this other thing all of a sudden, which is this immense sound, and like you say, with the orchestra, and the musicians just were so into it as well. They really, it was beautiful. It was a really lovely experience, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing.
We can't not talk about sex, drugs and rock and roll and your incredible performances as Ian Dury. And I know you're a big fan of his as well, and whether that going into it kind of made it easier because you knew him to a point.
Yeah, I'd actually been very fortunate in working with him very briefly. We were going to do a play called The Queen and I. We were workshopping. It was based on the Sue Townsend novel about the Queen being rehoused on a council estate in Leicester. And in fact, there was a TV version of it done this Christmas just passed. But anyway, there was going to be a play version, and Ian was writing the music. But it was a particular point in his life where he was at his angriest, I think. And he had been a massive kind of hero of mine. But when I actually did meet him and work with him, he was very, very cantankerous and very, very drunk a lot of the time. But you know, magnificent all the same. He was totally inspiring, and I think one of the most scary moments of making that film was literally the first thing I did, which was we fortunately got to record all of the songs with the original blockheads, the ones that are still around. And so my first day of meeting them was to go in. I'd been working on the character for about 6 months, so I'd lost a lot of weight, and I was kind of really getting into the zone. And I turned up on the first day, and we recorded, over 2 days, we recorded 18 Ian Dury songs with the blockheads in this really crappy old recording studio. And the first time I opened my mouth, it was just like, oh, here we go. You know, it was absolutely terrifying, because they could either have just all turned around and kind of gone, what are you playing at? You know, or, you know, and fortunately they didn't, which gave me the confidence to go on. But it was a remarkable journey. And again, his family were very, Ian's family, his son Baxter and daughter Jemima and, you know, wife Sophie were opened their hearts to, they loved the script, they loved the story. Matt Whitecross, of course, brilliant director. You know, we and Paul Virag, who wrote the script, we all had such a relationship with them, and it was a really great journey, actually, that film. That was a remarkable journey.
How do you feel about watching yourself back? Because we've got a clip if you want.
Oh my god. Oh, if you have to.
Yeah. This is courtesy of Matt Whitecross, by the way.
He's is it?
Over. Yeah, so this is a bit
special. Oh, is this it? This is actually...
No, this is the bit coming up next, but this is pretty special.
I made Mary cry in the lonely bus shelter.
Polio's a nasty business, really. Still, looking on the bright side, you do get a bit of reading done.
That was the one song that got cut from the movie, actually.
It's nice to get
something. Yeah, it is. It's lovely. Yeah, yeah, it's
so
great.
Kind of him to,
it's brilliant.
To send that over.
Yeah.
Can I talk just a little bit about working with an amazing collection of directors and what you've taken from that, whether it's, you know, Christopher Nolan, Peter Jackson, John Landis, there's so many, it's an amazing list of people, Matt obviously as well. If you do take things from those experiences of working with those people in terms of as a director and then how that then transfers to you as a director in any way?
Yeah, one of my greatest sort of kind of alliances and collaborations, I suppose, has obviously been with Peter Jackson over many, many years. We've done, so many films together. Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Hobbit trilogy, and Tintin and King Kong. And he is a remarkable director for the fact that not only a visionary, of course, but he is an incredibly compassionate and generous human being, and also a brilliant enabler and really values what everyone has to offer and therefore gets 150% out of people, because he's not a sort of despot as a director. You know, there are some who are very tough and you know, everyone to their own, but he is very much an open and he'll listen to everybody's opinions. And he also, one of the greatest things I learned about directing from another director is valuing everyone's opinion and collaborating and allowing people to bring their best, their very, very best to the table, and not feeling that you have to, although you're finally helming it and you're kind of overseeing it, that you're in some way, you don't have to know all the answers. And in fact, it's better to not know all the answers, because having 12 people, 100 people in a room, whatever, you're going to get so many great, great things. Just the way that he supports performance with camera, I've always, ever since going back to his early films, Heavenly Creatures being one, I remember seeing that and thinking, if ever I was to direct a movie, I think I'd probably want to direct it like that, just the way he literally moves the camera in a beautiful dance with, and at the same time, garners these extraordinary performances from people, which are totally in sync with the way the camera moves. And I think he's obviously been a huge impact, and he gave me a huge break directing the second unit on The Hobbit, which I shot for 200 days under his supervision and to his, creativity, and that was an amazing experience.
What's next, directing wise?
So we are making Animal Farm next.
Amazing.
Which is hopefully going to happen towards the end of this year. There are other things, but I'm not ready to divulge them right at the second. We're making that with Netflix. So who are great and have been really great with Mowgli. So very excited.
The people that we've spoken to on the podcast that have worked in the, it comes with an immense amount of creative freedom in terms of, they kind of go, yep. Go and make what you want to make.
That's absolutely right. They really do trust their filmmakers. They enable you to fulfil your vision. They're very hands-off unless things are going horribly wrong, I guess. Mm-hmm. They're an amazing, amazing... they come from film. That's the important thing to remember with all the talk about streaming versus film and the controversies that sort of lie within. But actually, the people at Netflix really do come from film, and they want to have that dual ambition of allowing, yes, of course, driving audiences to watch it on their streaming service, but at the same time, having their films in cinemas so that audiences can go and watch and have them both be complementary to each other.
Yeah. Nick, what about for you? What's next, film-wise?
Film-wise? I just come back from LA, so I was talking about different films. I'm actually, the films that I've talked about, I'm not allowed to talk about. But at the moment, I've got Traitors going on at the moment, which is on Channel 4. But this year is really also focusing on, we're commemorating an album I did ages ago called Beyond Skin, which was about 20 years ago. So we're doing that at the Royal Albert Hall this year in September, which I'm excited about. And we're going to perform it through in its entirety as a live band, which should be really cool. But I mean... Yeah, there's a few series but we're in the middle of talking about them, so yeah.
Nick actually just did get off a flight from LA this morning, so thank you so much for being here. So glad it wasn't delayed, and thank you with all the jet lag and stuff as well. Thank you so much for your time. It's just really wonderful to chat to you. Thank you guys for giving up some of your Friday nights as well. Really, really appreciate it. And huge round of applause for our fantastic guests. Thank you, Jen. Thank you. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you. July 29th at 5:29 a.m., the gadget turned the pre-dawn sky as bright as the sun as the first atomic mushroom cloud rose above the horizon.
Multi-armed form and says, Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that, one way or another.
By Nitin Soni, that's the title track from his 1999 album Beyond Skin, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking Live with Nitin and Andy Serkis. My huge thanks to both Andy and Nitin for taking the time to join me at the BFI of a Friday night, and also to everyone for making us feel so very welcome. Mowgli Legend of the Jungle is available via Netflix now, and our next BFI Live event will be in May. Search for Soundtracking on Spotify to find a playlist for this show featuring the tracks we featured in the order they appear. And do head to iTunes or edithbowman.com to subscribe to the podcast and catch up with all of our previous episodes. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter at Soundtracking UK. Next up, I'm joined by screenwriter Nicole Taylor, director Tom Harper and actress Jessie Buckley to discuss their wonderful new film, Wild Rose. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.